Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Coming up on Word of Mouth, the other drug war south of the border. We'll look into the multi-billion dollar growth industry currently conducting drug trials in developing nations. And a culture writer on how politics plays on popular TV shows like Glee, often cutting quite close to the bone.
Stu Sylvester is running for state representative in a campaign that's supposed to be totally ridiculous. She's claiming that the arts are ruining students' lives. That would be hilarious and ridiculous if it hadn't actually happened in Kansas.
And an exploration of peacock's tales, whale song, and other examples of wildlife artistry. An argument that beauty in nature is not arbitrary and deserves more attention from science.
If you want to study the Song of the Mockingbird as a biology student, your advisors will say, don't do it. They're too different from one another.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Don't hate word of mouth because it's beautiful. It's coming up after the headlines on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on this Saturday, a culture reporter votes for TV shows that get politics right. Nature's bent for beauty defies evolutionary principles. And if you traded in your Halloween costume for snow pants in the ugly aftermath of last weekend's storm, we'll send you delayed trick-or-treaters off with tips for surviving an attack of the zombies. But we begin with the very real drug war south of the border. Not from the cartels, but unauthorized drug trials. Last year, details of public health workers deliberately infecting Guatemalan prisoners with syphilis in the 1940s were made public. President Obama apologized, and American government officials assured the public that regulatory oversight would prevent such ethical lapses today. Deliberate dosing aside, investigative journalist Kelly Hearn reports in The Nation that regulatory loopholes and corruption continue, and that the pharmaceutical industry now outsources drug trials to contractors. It's a $20 billion industry and growing quickly, especially in South and Central America. We spoke with him earlier this week from Argentina. So the Guatemalan prison case, of course, the Tuskegee experiments, there is a history of ethical breaches in medical research. So what kind of regulations have been put in place to prevent that in human testing?
Well, there have been many regulations, and I guess the institutions which have stepped forward to sort of mitigate those sorts of problems or to keep them from happening are institutional review boards or ethical review committees. And these are basically voluntary committees of varying types of experts that have the power to oversee clinical trials and to make sure that they're protecting the rights and welfare of human research subjects. So when we talk about Guatemala, that is a case of overt criminality. And I think most of the people that I talk to would agree that the world really doesn't have to worry about that level of thing happening again. Mostly there are concerns that medical expediency is winning out over human rights. And when I say human rights, I mean more things like informed consent in clinical trials. What we're seeing now is that 10 years ago or so, most clinical trials that took place in American academic institutions.
Uh-huh.
But now it's a global game, and it's dominated by corporations called contract research organizations. And as you noted, it's a $20 billion industry. The problem is that the FDA is swamped. They're hit by budget cuts. They're unable to review this data, to verify the quality of the data, and to ensure that the rights of subjects are protected. In 2008, 40 to 65% of clinical trials on FDA-related products took place overseas. But of nearly 6,500 foreign trial sites that year, the FDA inspected only 45.
Wow.
And that's less than 1%.
Less than 1%. Okay, so this is the question. Their U.S. drug company, does the FDA have jurisdiction over trials on their behalf, even if they take place someplace else?
The FDA has jurisdiction over any device or drug that enters the United States market. And let me tell you, one of the major crux of this whole issue, the regulatory loophole, has to do with something called an investigational new drug application, or IND. If you and I wanted to test a new drug or device, we have to go to the FDA, and this is in the United States, we have to go to the FDA, file an IND, and that puts us on the FDA's radar. That gives them time to look and see that the study is ethical and can go forward. If you are a federally funded researcher going out of the United States, you also have to get an IND, but you do not have to get an IND if you are a company. if you're a private company. So the fear is that these companies can go to, say, Africa or Bosnia or Bolivia without letting the FDA know in advance what's going on. They can test a drug or device, and if that test goes well, yippee, we take it back to the FDA, and if it doesn't, you close shop.
Mm. Give us an example of a study approved south of the border that would have never seen the light of day in the U.S. I was thinking of this Dominican, the HIV trial that you wrote
right.
about.
In the early 2000s, the Fogarty Institute funded a U.S. researcher at the University of Miami, and she was trying to determine if massage therapy would boost the immune systems of HIV-positive children in the Dominican Republic. So these kids were dying of AIDS, but they were not taking antiretroviral drugs that were available in the United States at that time. So what happened was the researcher went to the Dominican Republic into a slum, paid 48 families $5 per clinic visit, twice a week for 12 weeks. The children were then randomized into two groups. One received therapeutic massage. The other, made of 12 HIV-positive children, again, met with a nurse for, quote, reading, talking, playing quiet games as part of a friendly visit control group. When that study was finished, according to a report in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, the researchers basically packed their bags and left without offering any of these dying children life-saving drugs.
Well, it looks like this story is far from over as U.S. Health and Human Services considers making new changes to research regulations. What are you looking at going forward? Is the problem going to get better or worse?
So the question is, do you set up regulations that streamline things and decrease confusion? Or do you try to hold a tighter line, but maybe inadvertently creating, you know, more paperwork and more headaches and holding back medical advances? So quite frankly, the answer is, I don't know better or worse, but certainly more complicated.
Well, I know you're joining us from Argentina today. I really want to thank you so much for making the time, Kelly.
Sure, thank you.
Kelly Hearn, an investigative journalist, he reported on the rise of unregulated drug trials being outsourced by the pharmaceutical industry to South and to Central America. You'll find more, including a link to the article, at wordofmouthradio.org. A study of census data north of the border shows that extreme poverty has grown by more than one-third over the past decade. This after the Congressional Budget Office reported that income among the wealthiest 1% of Americans has tripled over the past 30 years. The numbers fit neatly with the Occupy movement's "We Are the 99% tagline and protests for a more fair distribution of wealth. Princeton economist Ileana Kuzmenko and Michael Norton from the Harvard Business School found that the people closest to the poverty line are the least supportive of policies to aid the poorest Americans. The segment is opposed to supporting raises in the minimum wage and more willing to move benefits upward than down. It's a paradox and a theory called last place aversion, which could explain why those suffering the most in this economy don't support radically changing it. Here's Ileana Kuzmenko.
So I think the best way of conceptualizing last place aversion is to think what it was like when you were a little kid and you were in gym class or recess. I think the fear that all kids have at that moment is that they're going to be picked last. Our thought was that that fear doesn't go away just because you grow up, and that while we all sort of care about where we stand in relationship to others, that concern is especially heightened when you're near the bottom of the distribution. So if you're sort of at the bottom of the distribution, you might be worried that a redistributive program would actually help people who are just below you.
So you bore this out in experiments. Tell us
so
a little
the,
bit about
that. Experiment that was probably the most convincing. We randomly placed people in an income distribution. They're each separated by $1, and they know their amount. They can see everybody else. It's a computer game, but they can see everybody else in the distribution. So they know, you know, if they have $3, there's a guy below them, there's a couple guys above them, et cetera. And everyone's separated by $1. Each player at that point gets an extra $2 that they have to decide to give to the person directly below them or directly above them. And note, because they are separated by $1, giving the $2 to the person below you means they jump over you. But most people in the distribution say, well, you know, why should I give it to the person with more money than me? I can't keep the money myself. I'll just give it to the person below me. But the person in second to last place, you know, in some of these experiments, about half the time they'd actually give it to the person with more money than them in order to avoid giving it to the person below them.
It's kind of in keeping with current surveys. Even during the recession, it's indicated that support for redistributing wealth has actually gone down.
It's so hard to know at this point. I mean, so we've looked at general social survey data, and this is a survey that's asked many questions. One of the questions they've asked consistently is, do you agree with the statement the government should do more to reduce income differences? And between 2008 and 2010, which are the two most recent years they've done the survey, support for that statement falls across, you know, almost every demographic group we looked at.
Which is interesting. It may be expected among wealthy white people who do, in this economy, have much more to lose.
Exactly, but it also fell among people who self-report as being below average income. And to some extent, this shouldn't surprise us, right? I mean, we just saw in 2010 a Republican landslide, and unless I missed it, none of those guys were, you know, promising redistribution.
Well, the timing of your results could not be more in keeping with the zeitgeist. I mean, the CBO data, the Occupy Wall Street movement, but without the working poor behind them, is the timing right for Occupy Wall Street?
Who knows? I mean, one thing that I think is really interesting about Occupy Wall Street, and that our research points, you know, would suggest that it's a very smart move on their part. Their framing is, we are the 99, and, you know, our work says when lower income people, at least in our experiments, are made to focus on the people below them, they become wary of redistribution. But it seems like Occupy Wall Street is really trying to get that group to focus on the people above them. Of course, there's a counter to Occupy Wall Street, which is calling themselves We Are the 53%,
right,
which is somewhat brilliant as well, to get the working class to focus on themselves instead of the top 1%. So
we'll see who wins out in the framing wars. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you.
Ileana Kuzmenko, Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. She and Michael Norton from the Harvard Business School recently wrote in Scientific American about research into attitudes on wealth reallocation and what they call the last place aversion paradox. You can find the article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And when we come back, politics on TV. Nothing new, but it's on sitcoms and dramas now. That's when Word of Mouth returns in just a minute on NHPR. Welcome back. Earlier this week, a post on the LA Times blog detailed the shaky fate of Portsmouth's River Run bookstore. For full disclosure, it's one of the producing partners of NHPR's Writers on a New England Stage series. Store owner Tom Holbrook alerted customers that River Run needs a less expensive location and new investors. In an email to them, he wrote, "When we moved into this space, the economy was good and the Kindle didn't exist. We've hung on for the last 2 years hoping things would improve, but they haven't." The news brings home the distressed fate of brick-and-mortar booksellers in a market dominated by Amazon. The online retail juggernaut has been offering self-publishing tools to authors and is now taking aim at the book printing business. In August, Amazon made the leap to actually striking deals with big-name authors, starting with food writer Timothy Ferris. We spoke to Jason Bogue, editor of the publishing website Gallycat, about Amazon clawing its way up the publishing food chain.
You know, what happened is Amazon has actually set up an office in New York City, kind of encroaching right into the physical space of the publishing industry itself. And Timothy Ferris actually negotiated his deal himself with Amazon. He saw an opportunity. He saw that distribution channels were changing and went straight to them. The other big name that they just recently sealed, they paid, I believe, $800,000 was the figure quoted by a New York Times article for Penny Marshall, the great director and actress's memoir.
Well, publishers, of course, do more than just print books. They do, you know, artist advocacy. They do appearances, publicity, that kind of thing. Is Amazon going to fill in that gap?
Yeah, they're pushing really hard into that space as well. They've hired some very prominent editors and agents to actually run this new publishing business. So if you have a good team like that, you can be formidable.
Amazon is a leader in the business of self-publishing, too, but you've been covering a much more grassroots effort to self-publish. This is the Occupy Wall Street Poetry Anthology. What is it?
Yeah, I don't think many people know this, but the Occupy Wall Street movement has poetry readings on a regular basis poets from all over the city, all over the country, are coming there to visit. The most prominent guest who visited most recently was Patti Smith, the memoirist and rock star. Great writer. She went and voiced her support. But these people are reading poetry and just talking with the community. And so the Occupy Wall Street librarians, the people running the makeshift collection of books that they have there, have actually self-published in a binder. They've printed off poems from different people and put it together. And if you're down at the site, you can actually read and check out this this poetry anthology.
Well, they're kind of capitalizing on the brand, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, they're capitalizing on the fact that they have so many poets coming down. The Wall Street Journal interviewed the librarians, and they said on any given night, you could have an NYU professor reading poetry, followed by some young protester from somewhere else. And so it's just this very democratic platform that you don't usually see.
Jason Bogue, I really want to thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Jason Bogue is editor of the publishing website Gallycat, and you will find links to that site. Also, his blogs about Amazon's new venture and the Occupy Wall Street writers movement, all at wordofmouthradio.org. And we also have posted a link to our conversation with the writer Jeff Charlotte about a movement that he helped start called Occupy Writers. Primary season politics make for plenty of good mass market theater. Just listen to this clip of Texas Governor Rick Perry's so-called drunk speech being passed around now online.
This is such a cool state. I mean, come on, live free or die. I mean, you know, you gotta love that, right? I come from a state, you know, where they had this little place called the Alamo, and they declared victory or death. You know, we're kind of into those slogans, man. It's like, live free or die, victory or death. Bring it.
Since the Nixon-Kennedy debates, TV and politics have made a lively, if not always loving, couple. But the truth has often played better than fiction. Alyssa Rosenberg, culture blogger at Think Progress and a columnist for The Atlantic, looked at how TV sitcoms and dramas are reflecting the campaign mania.
Well, we've had this explosion of television shows that are about politics and not just about the sort of national politics where people go on television and do a big national televised debate. They are about the sort of door-to-door, you know, city council vote counting, sort of grassroots politics in a way that's kind of entertaining. You've got Leslie Knope, the diehard Parks and Recreation assistant director on the show of the same name, who's running for city council in Pawnee, Indiana. You have Sue Sylvester and Kurt Hummel's dad squaring off for a state representative seat on Glee. You've got Claire Dunphy running for city council on Modern Family, and you have Kelsey Grammer making a return to television in a really striking dramatic turn as Chicago Mayor Tom Kane on Boss.
All right, let's start with a show that doesn't try for a nuanced approach. Here is a clip from Glee in which the Cheerio cheerleader Brittany is summing up her campaign for student council before launching into song. Very Glee style.
Yeah, Kurt looks like Jimmy Fallon's butch daughter, but a vote for him would only empower yet another Frankenbeans.
Yes. Where has that patriarchy gotten us? Double-digit inflation, economic freefall, oil spills, war in Afghanistan.
I tweeted about Brit's flash mob pep rally in the gym, and we're all showing up to support her with girl power.
Yes. Boys have made one hell of a mess in this school, and there's only one way to clean it up.
So how many actual campaigns are using Beyonce to shore up their base these days, Alyssa?
You know, politics would be more fun if more of them would. You know, I mean, I think Glee has been sort of fascinating because it's had this overarching storyline this season where the evil cheerleading coach Sue Sylvester is running for state representative in a campaign that's supposed to be totally ridiculous. She's claiming that the arts are ruining students' lives and is pledging to cut arts funding. That would be hilarious and ridiculous if it hadn't actually happened in Kansas. Kansas governor, Sam Brownback, managed to defund and dismantle the Kansas State Arts Agency this year, which means that the state also has to forfeit all of its federal arts funding because it's contingent on a state match. So Sue may be over the top and ridiculous, but she's actually highlighting a fairly important issue that is going to cost people jobs and is going to cost communities arts programming in Kansas, sort of in an adjacent state. Brittany's campaign is sort of funny because I think it gets at a kind of shallow idea that all we need are women in politics, or, mm-hmm. you know, all we need is to sort of check off a quota. We need women, we need black people, then everything will be different.
Well, you mentioned Boss. Now, this is Kelsey Grammer's new role. I haven't seen it yet, but your writing about it made me very interested. This is from the first episode. Now, he's Mayor Kane. Kane, funny choice for a name there, has just received a terrible diagnosis after taking only a few minutes to compose himself. Here he is speaking to a crowd.
Today, the First Presbyterian still holds daily services. It stands as a testament to an abiding truth about the nature of this great city, this most American of all cities. Chicago!
Mayor of Chicago there, played by Kelsey Grammer. You know, it's interesting. It's so easy to sort of paint a satire in something like Glee. It's a little bit different to play politics seriously.
It is. And I mean, I think I talked to Mr. Grammer about the show. And, you know, one of the things that he said that I have mixed feelings about is that they were trying to tell a story that wasn't about politics, that was about power and what happens when people are threatened with the loss of power and what it means to accumulate power. And I think that that's a fair project. But I think it's important to acknowledge that parties do different things when they have power, and they treat power in different ways. And, you know, TV can be a little scared of partisan politics sometimes.
Do you think, Alyssa, after the election, people's interest is going to wane in those political subdramas?
We live in a sort of constant political environment, and I'm actually surprised that shows don't have sort of a constant political undercurrent because of it. On the other hand, maybe everyone just gets burned out most of the time, needs something to escape from, and then politics sort of, you know, has a resurgence in a particularly colorful or eccentric election year.
Well, tell us about it. We're living in New Hampshire, and Alyssa, I want to thank you so much.
My hat to you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Alyssa Rosenberg, culture blogger at Think Progress and a columnist for The Atlantic. You can find a link to her article from Boss to Glee. Do any of these season shows get politics right? That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, an overlooked evolutionary principle, survival of the beautiful. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth returns from NHPR.
Welcome back.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species in 1859, questions about the astonishing variation between living things focused on survival, procreation, and evading predators, not necessarily on nature's peculiar aesthetics, about the peacock's preference for a plumage of a particular hue, for example, or why individual mockingbirds are so choosy about which songs to imitate. David Rothenberg is professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and the author of several books, including Why Birds Sing. His latest is Survival of the Beautiful, a contemplative book which asks why beauty exists in nature and why do biologists tend to say it doesn't matter. His examples of the beauty instinct come from nature, like the discovery of an extraordinary piece of artwork found while on a walkabout in Australia.
Well, I was wandering through the forest, you know, kind of in the wilderness in Queensland, in the Lamington National Park, and I came across a pile of garbage, a pile of blue plastic spoons in the middle of nowhere. And I said, like, what? Who would leave this sort of thing here? This is ridiculous. And then my guide, the ornithologist Sid Curtis, he said, what are you talking about? That's what's left of the bower of a satin bower bird. He builds these structures and he decorates them with blue. He can use blue flowers, or if he can't find any blue flowers, blue plastic works just fine. And that was my first personal introduction to the artwork of bower birds.
Hmm.
I'd heard about these birds, but it really doesn't make any sense if you see it. You know, if you see it in the middle of the woods and you say a bird has just built this, and then, you know, many people think, oh, this is his nest, and he has to have a blue decorated nest, and then you learn, like, no, it is not a nest. It's a sculpture the male bower bird builds to attract the attention of females who come check it out and assess whether they think it's any good.
It reminds me of the work of the contemporary artist Andy Goldsworthy, you know, who does
That's
these
right,
kind
Andy
of...
Goldsworthy clearly has learned from these bower birds. And, you know, David Attenborough asked him about this, and he very eloquently said, well, you know, I'm not a bird, but I certainly am aware of their work. It's like he's talking about some colleagues, some other artists. I'm not sure I like his work, but I'm aware of it.
Well, we do it's hard for listeners to maybe imagine this. So we do have a link to the Survival of the Beautiful website where you can see pictures of these just spectacular structures and birds. And there's actually a chart of the evolution of bower types. We have a link to that at wordofmouthradio.org. So this is all about attraction, David. This is something that Charles Darwin proposed, was to delight the minds of potential mates. But how did these various bower birds not get noticed and killed with their extraordinary showiness?
Two interesting questions you bring up. These bower bird bowers appear in many biology textbooks, and you will learn that this is yet another example of evolution. Extreme lengths males will go to get the attention of females. And this is what explains this phenomenon. And then modern biology goes on to say that, a bower bird that makes the best bower has the best quality. This is the one you should mate with. He's the smartest, he's the strongest, because he makes this thing. And that it once again showing an example of survival of the fittest, even in making these crazy artworks. There's just no limit to what males will do to attract the attention of females. But it's not what Charles Darwin thought this was about. You know, he had talked about survival of the fittest, how the most fit adaptations survive in nature. He was really vexed by things in nature that didn't seem to be especially useful or fit. Like, peacock's tail really makes me sick when I think about it, he wrote in a letter to a friend. Why? Because it doesn't seem very fit at all. It seems like a useless, crazy thing to have evolved that's excessive. And the bower bird's artwork is even more excessive. Like, why would such a thing evolve? How could birds sit for months in one place where predators could just pick him off and be doing this? It seems very unfit and rather stupid, actually.
So the question always being asked is, our scientific brain asks, how does it serve them? You're asking a different question.
Yeah, how does evolution produce such a beautiful world? Can we follow Darwin, who said aesthetics is a big part of evolution, the evolution of traits simply because females have evolved to like it? But this is a part of evolution that shows evolution is not just survival of the fittest, it's also survival of the interesting, survival of the beautiful. And that's why we get a world that is so interesting. It's not just a designed, functional, perfectly constructed, efficient thing that you would make if you wanted to engineer the most practical working world of life. That's not what we have. We have essentially, if you wind back evolution a few million years, start it again, you're not going to get these same creatures at all.
Then going further down the road with that idea, the survival of the beautiful, what is your theory on why the beautiful did or do survive?
Sometimes it's liked. Sometimes it is. Most birds are very tiny, efficient, invisible. They're kind of fast-moving creatures, for example. It very much evolved to fit their habitats, but often they have an aspect that also evolved simply because it's beautiful. That's why you look at your average creature or a flower or plants as well. They have a mixture of practical things and aesthetic features, both. And that's something Darwin recognized well, where he said natural selection and sexual selection are separate forces. They work together.
Thinking about sexual selection, it often explains to us why animals desire, but says very little about what they desired. Do animals have a natural aesthetic sense, do you think?
Each species has evolved its own aesthetic sense. Like, these bower birds have to build these bowers and decorate them with blue stuff, and they're born with that desire. They're born with that special aesthetic sense. How did it evolve over generations and generations of females kind of preferring this? Although we really don't know how something so weird could have evolved. I mean, it really is. That's how it's supposed to happen, but, it's very hard to prove. We could study more. We could try and figure out why blue. Is there any reason why blue? This is a whole sort of tension that's discussed in the book. How arbitrary are the choices that have evolved through sexual selection? How much do they depend on some kind of basic forms and ways nature is put together? Like, one reason that got me into this whole project was wondering why it was that you took the song of a humpback whale, this long 30-minute song that repeats up to 24 hours of singing. If you speed it up, it sounds a lot like a complex bird song, like a nightingale or a mockingbird.
We're talking with David Rothenberg, professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and author of several books, including Survival of the Beautiful. I'm thinking of the human animal here, of course. This quest, this appreciation is implanted in humans as well, who wanted to tell their stories in cave paintings for early humans. Is it just that we, as aesthetic creatures, appreciate that sound, that the song of a whale or the song of a bird or the color of a nest?
Well, on the one hand, there's things we appreciate. On the other hand, is that the birds appreciate it. In a few bird species, you know, a song with the most notes or the loudest leads to more success in mating. And there's often a lot written by a scientist about those species. They tend to ignore the other species where it's very hard to pick a correlation, where it's harder to know, you know, what the female birds like, whether the song actually is sexually determined. Every species in an aesthetic world unto itself. And we know so little about them, especially the more complex ones. We have no idea why mockingbirds need to make a complicated song out of the sounds of other birds. Mm-hmm. However, nobody has studied the aesthetic of the mockingbird. Why not? You know, if you want to study the song of the mockingbird as a biology student, your advisors will say, don't do it. You know, we've never been able to conclude anything objectively and certain about what these birds are doing. They're too different from one another. And I would say, yeah, what you need is someone with musical training to look at it, a musicologist to look at how this is structured and think differently than just trying to count the number of syllables or measure how loud things are.
So where does this urge reside when you're talking about things that are more interesting or aesthetically driven or sort of searching for light on some level? Where does that reside within humans or animals?
Part of it is innate. Part of it is learned, depending on the species and how they get their ideas of things. And a lot of it is completely unknown.
Well, you seem very down on biologists, David.
No, I'm not supposed to be. I'm very up I'm up in the sense of knowing what I'm talking about necessarily, but biology is amazing, but on these kind of questions, it is sort of veered away from looking at them.
Well, why has biology not studied the beautiful?
They feel it's too subjective and human rather than an objective part of nature. And it's a minority of people like Professor Richard Prum at Yale who says, let's study the evolution of beauty. It's really important. We can figure out amazing things like what color a dinosaur was by studying the evolution of beauty. By just saying everything's adaptation, we'll figure out how a dinosaur was perfectly adapted to eating this kind of prey, but we won't figure out what color it had unless we care about aesthetics. Why does that matter? You know, beauty is a part of evolution. It's a part of life. And it's what makes the world interesting. And the more we're aware of this, the more we'll appreciate the value of the world around us and the world where we evolved from.
David Rothenberg, professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and author of Survival of the Beautiful, Art, Science, and Evolution. In the background, we're listening to David making music with whales. That's the subject of a previous book, Thousand Mile Song. To see some of his photos of the amazing constructions of bowerbirds, as well as some other examples of nature's mysterious aesthetic sensibility, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Latin root of monster is also the word for warning. Throughout human history, sightings and stories of monsters warned humans off exploring dark landscapes and the unknown. Monsters give form to our deepest fears and provide societies with something to rally against. One explanation for the feelings of solidarity and release when we scream together at screenings of horror films. Stephen Asma is professor of philosophy at Columbia College in Chicago and author of On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Word of Mouth producer Rebecca Lavoie spoke to Stephen about deciphering the deeper meanings of monsters and how the idea of monsters has evolved through the ages.
Well, I take the position that in previous eras, we believed that monsters were literally true. And if you look at the ancients or the medievals, and even some sort of subcultures today, there's a strong belief that there are literal monsters out there, that you could be possessed by the devil, or that there's some sort of creature, you know, out there that means you harm, and that zombies are possible. But I think for most sort of educated people living today in America, monster is recognized as a kind of metaphor. It's part part of the way we sort of demonize people who are different from us. It's a part of how we project our fears and anxieties out there into the world. And so I accept this general sort of view that monsters are like, you know, 10% literal and 90% psychological. And so what I wanted to do was tell this story of what have different historical eras, what have they been afraid of? What have they projected out into the world and why? Try to connect it to the history and the philosophy of the time.
I'm really fascinated by the evolution of monsters in the 20th century, how they mirrored social changes, you know, from the teenage werewolf in the 50s, maybe representing emerging sexuality, to the body snatchers, maybe symbolizing the Red Scare. Talk about the monsters that have emerged in 21st century imagination. What do they represent and what are they?
Yeah, that's a good question. It seems like we're currently in this vogue of vampires, zombies, and I would say serial killers right now. These seem to be the three chief fears, although increasingly we're getting more monster films and stories about contagion, just disease that can wipe everybody out, and those kinds of apocalyptic stories. I think in our own period, you know, 9/11 has possibly given rise to the new wave of sort of torture porn. People have a lot of anxieties about security and stability and no clear sort of bad guy to point to. Instead, we have this sort of diffuse anxiety. It could be anybody at any time. And as a result, I think some of this stuff is getting played out in what looks like an uptick in horror films. I think zombies and vampires are funny because, you know, vampires are the elite, elegant monsters that are attractive. They go to all the right parties. You know, you want to be one of these people. Zombies are sort of exactly the opposite. They're the sort of proletarians of the monster world. In the case of vampires, this is something we're attracted to. We could live forever and be beautiful. But, of course, they're not human, and they represent the sort of sexual jeopardy. On the other hand, zombies look like what will happen if the power grid goes down.
I was going to ask you about that because I've heard some theorize that the zombie phenomenon specifically is kind of a delayed reaction to 9/11, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the perception being that there are people walking around, they just keep coming at us and that nothing we do can sway them from wanting to harm us. And, of course, the zombie metaphor is eating our brains. Does that resonate?
I think that makes sense. It's funny that in the original zombie films, things like George Romero's films, many social theorists linked them not to our enemies, but to us. They said, well, these are sort of funny spoofs or parodies on American consumerism. We, like zombies, parade around in shopping malls consuming without any sort of sense of purpose and this kind of stuff. And that's fairly compelling. But, you know, the zombie genre has changed, and it might be true that now zombies are being used differently, not as metaphors for ourselves, but as metaphors for the terrorists, so to speak, that there's a force out there that you can't reason with. I mean, and that's pretty clear if you remove the neocortex of the brain and the limbic system. You can't say to a zombie, hey, don't eat me, I have kids to take care of. And we have the same sort of anxieties about the terrorists. Well, we can't negotiate with them. And so that is playing on some of our deepest human fears.
So I have to ask, what are you most afraid of?
I am most afraid of deep water. I have this kind of phobia about what could be waiting, you know, in the murky depths to gnaw off my extremities. So, yeah, that's always been a fear of mine since I was a kid, and I think it's still there. I would consider myself a light phobic, not hardcore.
You think of Jaws as a light thing to be afraid of, then?
Well, I do resist swimming in the ocean whenever possible, but I haven't spoiled, like, a picnic or anything at the lake by refusing to go in the water or anything like that.
Producer Rebecca Lavoie there talking with Stephen Asma. He's a distinguished scholar and a professor of philosophy at Columbia College. He spent years digging through monster lore to find deeper cultural meanings. For a link to his book, On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org, where we've also posted some of our favorite monsters and confessed what we are most afraid of. The Guide section of New York Magazine is a place of record for spying on street fashion and where to buy it, or to zero in on the hippest new eatery this week.
It's also a reference for guiding savvy residents through more serious considerations, like what to do in the event of a citywide zombie attack. Luckily, increasing awareness of a potential assault by the undead has spawned an increase in zombie experts. Dan Coyce, a freelance journalist, assembled some of their expert advice in New York Magazine's guide for how to survive a zombie attack, a fight-or-flight primer to outliving the urban undead. We figured if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. So we welcome Dan Coyce to Word of Mouth. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
That title spells out the very first thing anyone should ask themselves after sighting a reanimated corpse. Do I stock up and stay put or pack up and get lost? What are the considerations?
It's a crucial question. And if you're in a very population-focused urban area, it becomes a live-or-die question within seconds because of how quickly zombieism can spread from person to person under many scenarios.
Now we did some quick math and added up everything in the go bag. And,
sure.
And you're looking at spending just shy of $1,000 on zombie prep. Now, given, Dan, today's not undead yet economy, can you recommend two or three reasonably priced can't live without items?
The first thing that I would suggest, and this is a suggestion we got from a professor at Columbia College Chicago who teaches a class on zombies and the media, was to don't worry about getting expensive weapons or the nicest shotgun or the fanciest crossbow, because really having those kinds of weapons just makes it tougher in many cases to fight zombies. It's really hard to hit a moving target in the head if you haven't been trained in crossbows. You can run out of ammo. Firearms really encourage overconfidence in a zombie situation. So I'd recommend something very simple like a crowbar. You know, it's heavy. It does a lot of the work for you when you're cracking heads. Plus, it can help you pry open doors in an emergency.
Okay. Well, survivors, of course, will have to face the truth that bullets will be in limited supply. Now, you did speak to the curator of arms and armor at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for tips on what kind of weapon they suggested would work during a zombie plague. Any more to pass on?
We did talk to them. A lot of local art museums do have arms and armory collections. I checked. I think a lot of the local museums in New Hampshire have limited collections. So you want to get there early to get the daggers and knives. But one great weapon, which you can get at the Met and many other museums with medieval collections, is a halberd, which is a long spear with an axe at the end of it, which is very useful because they give you a further reach than your standard axe or sword. It's about 8 or 10 feet long, so you can keep the zombies at bay while also slicing off their heads.
You did speak to two neuroscientists about what is going on inside of the zombie brain. Anything from their findings that will increase our chances for survival?
I think it's very crucial to understand what's going on inside the zombie brain. And in fact, one tip that we got that didn't make it into the issue, but which I think is really useful, and I'll share exclusively with you guys, is it's worth it to spend a little bit of time from an elevated location observing the zombies that are roaming your neighborhood to get a sense of what their abilities and limitations are. You know, can they see? Can they hear? Can they smell? Are they fast zombies, like out of 28 Days Later, or are they slow zombies, like out of a Romero movie? Once you've done that, you can sort of start to use that knowledge to fight them or flee them as necessary. And zombies, according to the neuroscientists we talked to, have real attention locking problem. You know, when they see something, they fixate. Usually it's that they see you, and they fixate on you and shuffle towards you, moaning brains. But it resembles a condition called balance syndrome. It's damage to the parietal lobe, which is a part of your brain up near the top in the middle. And a zombie will fixate on something, but if you can distract a zombie with a loud bang, or perhaps in the situation that you guys find yourselves in, a snowball against a tree, they may lose track of you entirely and fixate on that and walk away. One thing I would caution against, though, is, you know, people always think, this is a classic mistake, you could wave a stake at a zombie and toss it in one direction and they'll follow the stake. That is not going to work. There's a lot more meat on you than there is on a stake.
Dan Boyce, I'm so glad we got to talk to you today. I mean, it is really nice to know that there are some things that might help us. You have a couple of golden rules to live by in a post-zombie world. What are they?
Well, first of all, you have to decide whether you're going to go it alone or stick with friends. We really recommend going in a group. I mean, not a huge group. You don't want to find out that one of them is actually a zombie. You don't want one of them to turn against everyone else. But a small group of friends who you can trust is really valuable. We also really recommend, and this is a wonderful conversation I had with Rear Admiral Ali Khan, who is the director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response at the CDC. He recommends to make sure that if you do get bit, you don't deny it. You don't try and pass yourself off as healthy. You don't try and get into a group of people in hopes that they'll save you, because they won't. You'll turn into a zombie and you'll eat them all.
Hmm.
If you're bit, get to the ER immediately. They will have operations, procedures for how to deal with zombies. The CDC may already have come up with a treatment, but honestly, even if they haven't, even if you're doomed when you get bit, owning up to the infection, Rear Admiral Khan said, is another way of being a hero.
Oh, well. Dan, I really want to thank you for joining us in that sage advice.
My pleasure.
Dan Coyce writes for New York Magazine and is a founding editor of New York's culture blog, Vulture. For a link to his comprehensive zombie survival guide, visit wordofmouthradio.org while there's still time.
Because of the obvious threat to untold numbers of citizens, and because of the crisis which is even now developing, this radio station will remain on the air day and night.
And if you're among the many heading out for belated trick-or-treating this weekend, don't forget Dan's advice. Zombies are easily distracted, and thanks to last weekend's surprise snowstorm, there's still some coverage on the ground. So if you see a figure shuffling your way moaning, throw a snowball and find a small, trustworthy group and head straight to the nearest museum. We're so grateful that you could listen to this wide range of perspectives today, from the lyrical to the monstrous. There's more Word of Mouth online anytime, and you can listen to segments on demand and pass them along to friends at wordofmouthradio.org or on the free NHPR iPhone app. We also invite you to become a part of Word of Mouth's ongoing conversation with listeners. That's on our Facebook page, or send us a tweet with your ideas and thoughts on Word of Mouth, past, present, or future. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth returns next week with the sounds of more new ideas right here from New Hampshire Public Radio.